Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking technology today, and hopefully we can help some of your problems as we do on the second Monday of every month. We'll learn more about bots today, where they are online, how they can be helpful or dangerous, and we'll also talk about some security and privacy changes coming to Google. Our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew, back with us. Jesse's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He works with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. So, questions about how bots work? Do you have questions about privacy or security? Maybe a tech problem? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
A lot more companies are using bots in their services, and they're often online in places we may not even realize. Can you talk about what exactly a bot is and what some of their common uses are?
Yeah, most of the time, bots are really there to replace kind of a normal human interaction that we would have, whether it's talking to somebody on the phone or, you know, chatting with somebody online in kind of a conversation. So it's kind of a fake individual, really, to help you through a situation. I think we've all had calls, probably a variety of calls on the phone, especially where you've probably interacted with a bot. You kind of get you already know it's not a person because it does sound a little bit a little fake. It doesn't really sound like a real person. And where you have to, you know, key in codes in order to get through kind of a call tree. So a lot of the bots are really meant to facilitate customer service interactions to try to get you a solution sooner than what you would otherwise. So trying to skim off the top those primary concerns that people usually call in with and troubleshoot technical issues a little bit more effectively. I think on the other end, they can be frustrating because they never seem to quite get to where you want. You really want to speak to a person that can kind of, you know, think through the process. But there are a variety of bots that are more or less effective in being able to have that interaction and give you that answer really quickly. But it really is just creating an interaction that's helping to solve a problem for you, hopefully in a more effective way, because, you know, there are only so many people to answer questions. So it's a way to kind of offset the availability of people to be able to answer those questions effectively for you. And then, you know, in theory, you get the similar answer each time, because as individuals, we often make mistakes. So a bot can often make sure that individuals get the proper response to each interaction, where an individual, depending on the script, you know, may make a mistake. So it's really that replacement of that human interaction and problem solving that, in theory, is help to be automated.
Well, it so often has happened to me that I have a particular issue and the bot doesn't quite understand the issue that I have. And so it can be really frustrating sometimes. They play a role in things like search engines as well. When we use Google, they help deliver, I think, useful results. Is that right?
Yeah, it helps to, and, you know, there's a variety of ways to look at bots or at automation. Some of them are very interactive. Some people might also look at search engines and a variety of other technologies that try to give you hints as to what you're looking for before you even know what they are. Within, like, Google, for example, and a variety of other search engines, when you do search for things, it will try to tack on additional information, basically understanding that most people are looking for this, or if you have a Google profile, it might have a good indication on, based on what you've done before or your own profile, what you may be looking for. So it takes a lot of those clues to help guide you to that proper answer. And I think that's a nice benefit, too, when looking at different service providers. You know, if your internet goes down, for example, if a bot has access to a lot of this data, they can help to automate the delivery of information before you might even know to ask. So if I have a service issue, I call up, it knows my phone number, it knows, you know, geographically where I'm located. It may also know, hey, there's been an outage. It can actually proactively give you that information, saving time for people on the phones to address other issues while making sure that people get that information as soon as possible. So it really is ideally there to save time for everyone in the end.
Are there ways, well, I know, I'm pretty sure there are ways that bots can be used in a negative fashion.
Yeah, there are a variety of ways. I think we've all had robocalls or other interactions where there is something on the other end of the line that's trying to get information from you or trying to get some kind of engagement. So you will give it information. It may only be looking for a reply of yes, so it can feed that into something else. So you get even more robocalls. I think one of the places we've probably seen it more often is Twitter bots or Facebook bots. Information that's being put out there through social media that may not be from a real individual, and it could be serving to put out disinformation or to, you know, even take real information but put it out there in a way that it gets more visibility. You can even think about it, and you could even use it for marketing in a variety. There's a lot of purposes to use bots. To answer questions, to get communications out there. It can be used to solve problems, but it can also be used to leak information, whether it's good or bad.
You know, you mentioned marketing, and Liz in Eau Claire has a question that kind of relates to that. Liz, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi there, thank you. I have two questions that are related. One is, I've recently begun to get emails that are marketing, and there's no place to unsubscribe, or if there is, it'll take me to more advertising rather than unsubscribe. That's one. The related one is, if I do get an unsubscribe and it asks me to enter the email address I want subscribed, should I do that? Are they phishing to get my email confirmed? And those are my two questions.
All right. Thanks for calling. Well, what do you think, Jesse?
Those are really good questions. So looking at the first one, when you do get a lot of these calls, or whether it's emails or phone calls, they're going to get a lot of that information in a variety of ways. Unfortunately, the way a lot of our systems are, we're digitally connected with social media, with email. They could even be getting your information from somebody else because you happen to be in somebody else's address book or somebody else may have been phished. If it's a reputable company, because a lot of people do actually purchase this information so that they can market to you, there are ways to actually get unsubscribed from a variety of these sources, and it can take time for it to basically remove that information from all these data aggregators. First, I would look for those specific services you're receiving the information from to see how you can unsubscribe. There are a variety of data brokers out there, PeopleFinder, Spokio, and even more that you can actually find this information. One thing I always like to do, you might also want to Google yourself or Google your own email. You might find out that it's actually listed in a variety of other places that you weren't anticipating, and you can actually go through and find ways to unsubscribe it. I have done this before, and I think the first time I did this, because I did find like a 50 or 60 page PDF, and there's a variety of services you can go to, it took a solid chunk of several hours to go through and to remove your information. I can also probably update a little bit later and make sure we have that on the website for a link to some good services. But I'd actually Google your information to see those where it might come up and actually try to unsubscribe from those various sources. But if you do look for data aggregators or data brokers, many times you can unsubscribe from them, and over time that will filter through all these other locations that are subscribing to it because they're also ingesting that opt-out information, and they will eventually remove your info, and hopefully you'll have a cleaner inbox. On the other side, too, kind of on the second question, that information, if you are unsubscribing, do you give your information or not? If you already received the email, they already have your email address, so I would say it's probably less of an issue if you supplied it again. They already have that information. It also depends on the service, if it does seem reputable, and that can be kind of hard to understand. But if it's a large name brand that you recognize and the website is coming from that site, that you can be very clear of what it is, I think it's okay to give your information there, especially if they've already supplied it. You're not giving them new information. And hopefully that unsubscription will get you removed. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have with email and everything else these days. A lot of people are you're getting this information, so they're trying to collect data on you, whether it's your phone number or your email address, so they can get you more and more via these other channels and follow, you know, fill up your inbox, fill up your voicemail with all this information. I think one of the recommendations that's even more difficult to go through when thinking about privacy and kind of safeguarding that information that you get is to actually have email accounts for specific purposes, potentially for specific accounts. It does become a kind of a management nightmare. I think most people are used to maybe having one or two email accounts, but when you think about doing that for all the different services that you use, it becomes a headache because you don't know which accounts, you may not know which passwords. One thing I would recommend when you are signing up for anything, there's usually going to be some kind of marketing component that's usually an opt-out rather than an opt-in. So I always recommend taking a look at those checkboxes. If you don't feel comfortable, don't give that information. Or you can also create an email address that's only used for those purposes. So you're funneling people towards this kind of junk email box to begin with. And then if you want to check it, you can go there as well. That's also a potential for your own email account. If you know the people you communicate with on a regular basis, you could always create a new email account, tell them to use the new one, and then leave the old one basically for that garbage to collect. That can also be a challenge, but it's an option. I think it is useful to go through those data aggregators, and you can actually remove them from a few common ones, and it will eventually filter down. But the more you use technology, the more you use applications, the more you share that information with others, it's very likely to get picked up from those other sources as well. If I use an app, if I use an application on my phone, for example, and it has access to my contact list, it may be able to get that and use it for marketing purposes as well. So even if you do the best you can with your information, if someone else has it, they may unknowingly be sharing it with others. So it's kind of a challenge because everyone kind of impacts how your information gets out there.
Liz, thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, as we talk with him about security and privacy when working remotely. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Jana Rose Schleiss, our on-air producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today and security around it with our guest, Jesse LeGrew. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. We have a number of callers online. I think we'll go right back to the phones, and Craig in Plover is up next. Craig, hi. Thank you for calling. We lose Craig? Yeah, I think we just lost Craig. Well, let's go to Mary Ann in Eau Claire then. Mary Ann, hello. Mary Ann, are you there? Oh. Well, Let's try Ann in Madison then.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Ann.
How are you?
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, so I only have one credit card, and I recently changed the number on that credit card. So when I received an email from Netflix saying, "We're having trouble charging your account. Would you please press this link and update your information?" When I got that email, I thought, yeah, that makes sense, because I just changed my credit card. So I pressed the link, and I went into it, and I started to do it, and then I thought, you know, this doesn't seem right. It doesn't feel right. So I backed out of it, and I went to Netflix official website, and I got their number, and I called them, and they said, "Gee, we don't even find an account for you." And I do watch Netflix all the time. "We don't even find an account for you." Well, then it occurred to me, I don't even have a Netflix account. I'm on my son's account. So Netflix doesn't know me. There's no reason why I would have gotten an email from them to update my credit card information. So then my question is just the fact that I had recently changed my credit card, did that generate this email, this spam email?
What do you think, Jesse?
It's a possibility that it generated it. A lot of those emails go through fairly frequently, and so they actually send them out to basically any email they can get, because the chances are someone does have a Netflix account, and people will click on those emails even if they have not received a new credit card. I think in this case it was a very, very probably lucky coincidence on their part, because it really did coincide with actually getting a new credit card. And so it was very, very likely that, you know, you were going to be like, "Oh, I just got a new credit card. I need to click." And really what they're trying to do is they're just trying to get your credit card information. They're hoping you're going to fill in the form, hit submit, and they'll have that data. So I think in this case, it's probably just coincidence and timing that you received it pretty much at the exact same time that where you got the new credit card. It could have been received in a few other ways. I'd probably say it's coincidence. They tend to broadcast these in a very, very wide scope to just about anyone, and you will see them from Netflix, Amazon, any large company, especially ones that have subscriptions. You're going to see these emails coming in, and they're not always filtered out as junk mail or emails you shouldn't be seeing. They do really well at also making the websites look really, really professional and legitimate. So it's always a good idea to look at that top bar where it has the address and see if it does say Netflix.com. And if it does look suspicious, you did exactly what I would tell anyone to do. Go to the original website, take a look. You contacted them. They actually gave you, you know, the feedback that you needed. That would be the recommendation I'd always tell to anyone. You did, you know, what everyone should be doing, which is verifying that information by going directly to the source instead of using the information in the email. So those were great steps to follow.
Yeah, exactly. And thank you for calling. Leah in Mount Ida, it's your turn. Hi, Leah.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Me too, except that I'm just being inundated with junk mail that arrives in my primary email address account, and it's sent to a different address that is not mine, and an address that's at zoominternet.net, and there's some name and number attached to that as part of the address. I'm not explaining that very well. But each email address has a click here to manage your email subscription. I always just select them, delete them immediately. But I did put it in my blocked sender list, but they still keep coming into my inbox, even though they're identified at the top as saying this message is from a sender in your blocked list. So,
wow.
I'm not... Yeah.
That's frustrating, you know, for sure. What's going on there, Jesse?
There could be a variety of things with how the emails are viewed. I know that if you do use Gmail, you have different ways to view your inbox, which will actually also show you, you know, information in your junk email folder. Usually you want that kind of filtered inbox view. That could help at least with seeing it. One item that I'd recommend, and this is with whatever email you're using, whether it's through Microsoft, Gmail, or somewhere else, is they do have spam or phishing reporting capabilities, usually right in the web client, where you can click, I want to report this email, I want to report this email. If you're not doing that already, I would highly recommend doing that because that will report it to the service providers, and they'll use that to try to remove those emails in the future. And so it not only helps you receive less of those, hopefully, in your inbox, it actually does help others because they're able to spot those a little bit sooner. They can remove that from visibility from other individuals' inboxes as well. Outside of that, I'd also consider just looking at your junk mail filters just to see kind of what the setting is. Junk mail filters can be a little bit challenging because you don't want to filter out good emails. You want to get those so you can read them, and you want to make sure that the emails that you don't want because they're malicious or they're just simply junk mail, you want to make sure those are filtered out. So it can be kind of a delicate balance. But I'd recommend taking a look at your junk mail filters as well. But if you haven't already, outside of just blocking it, I would consider the report spam or report phishing emails that are likely built into the email that you're using.
There you go, Leah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Judy in Madison up next. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a robocall question. I have Charter. My landline is through Charter, and they have an option where you can block robocalls. And I can usually tell when a robocall has come in because the phone only rings once, and then it quits. How does Charter recognize robocalls?
Jesse, what do you think?
So I can't note anything specifically that Charter has on their end, but just like phishing emails and a variety of other kind of junk mail, whether it's digital or physical, that come through, there are a variety of organizations that actually share and populate kind of central databases with phone numbers that are phone banks for robocalls, or that might even be email addresses that send malicious or phishing emails, for example. So at least, you know, I'm making some assumptions on my case. It's likely that they are subscribed to a service where they can actually filter out phone calls based on the senders or even potentially the content of the phone call. It kind of depends on what technology you want to go with. I would guess that it's usually probably kind of a block list that they're subscribed to, and they will actually remove those phone calls from basically you being able to receive them. That's a guess on my part. There's a variety of other ways that you can do it. I think just like the robocalls or the bot calls that we get, you know pretty quickly whether it is a phone call that's a bot, because they generally say the same thing. The voice is usually very similar. So there could also be other technologies in use that actually pick up the phone call a little bit earlier to listen for common responses that would also indicate a robocall or information that could be not a real person. So those are a couple guesses. I don't know specifically what they're using, but those are at least a couple ways they could be doing it. I would think using a block call list that's probably centralized. They might even subscribe to it or manage it themselves. They're probably using. The downside is phone numbers are really easily to be spoofed or falsified. So there are a variety of ways around that easily if you kind of do this full time. But if somebody does spot it, it just creates that, it just takes that one time for them to be put in a block list. Downside is you could find yourself someday on a block list, even if you're not robocalling, because people might use your own phone number. So there's a lot of tricks out there, but it's likely a subscription, I would guess, that they're subscribed to help with that.
And Judy, thank you so much. Sandy in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Sandy.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
My question is, are there any recommended VPN apps that I can use on my iPhone? I've used one in the past, and it was it slowed my phone down so much that I pretty much turned it off. It was pretty fussy VPN app. I thought it was rated at the time as the best, but it wasn't for me. Any suggestions?
And VPN is, by the way, somebody's wondering that already.
Yeah, virtual private network. So a VPN can be used in a variety of ways to connect to remote resources. So a lot of people now that are working or learning from home may use a VPN to get connected to your institution or to your workplace. So it's kind of like you're on their network without actually physically being there. So it's great for remote connectivity, but it can also be good for privacy in that it helps to create a kind of a secure tunnel so that your traffic cannot be easily read. So it keeps your data a little bit more safe. It's actually really, really useful if you're traveling or using like hotel wireless or are in locations that you're just not sure of the security of their networks. So in terms of products, first I'll kind of just talk about the iPhone in general. And this is not just iPhone specific. This might be Android. VPN can be a little bit more challenging if you're using a cellular connection. It can be a bit too much overhead in terms of being able to give you very good response times when navigating different websites or different network services. So the VPN, even if you go to a different service, it may not improve the overall performance if you are on cellular. If you have a pretty fast speed internet connection on cellular, it's going to give you a better performance. If you're on wireless and connected to VPN, that'll be much, much better. So even if we do look at a VPN, your cellular connection itself actually might be a challenge. That being said, in terms of different VPN services, there's a variety of VPN services that are out there. And I'd probably, and there are free services and there are paid services. If you do use VPN often and it's something that you are concerned about, either for privacy or just because you want better performance, I would consider paying for a service. They actually do have services that could have monthly or yearly subscriptions. Sometimes they might even be bundled with your internet service provider. So I'd actually take a look if you do have DSL cable or other internet connectivity at home. They may have some of those services built in. I know they do generally have antivirus and other services, but see what they might have available that might be free or lower cost. Same thing with your cellular provider as well. Services that I've heard of and used before, NordVPN, OpenVPN. There are many, many VPN services out there. I would look for something that is largely reliable, and there's a variety of review sites out there. NordVPN is a very, very popular one. But there's also a variety of features with a VPN client that even if you're not sure you want, might be interesting because they can actually give you reporting and data that you might have never thought about. Or you can also use it for family plans, which could allow you or other family members to use the service to protect everyone's internet connection, but also to ensure that maybe you want certain parental filtering or content filtering in place as well. So different VPN services can offer benefits for that. I would actually just look at highly rated VPN services that have been around for quite a while. I think with the current situation, there are a variety of remote service options for VPN and other services kind of spinning up. I would look for services that have been in place for quite some time, because there also can be challenges with VPN where, while they can secure your connection, that secured connection can also be used to eavesdrop on your communications as well. It's built there to protect you, but it does mean that it can potentially be one point to also compromise your internet connection. So use a reputable service, and do a little bit of research and also see what the rest of your family is looking for. But I would also test when using wireless, and also test with cellular. Usually they will have a 30-day subscription that you can try out for free. But if you do notice a consistently poor interaction, it very well could be that cellular connection itself. Using Wi-Fi might help to resolve it, but if you only have cellular and that's really what you're looking for, you might have limited options.
There you go, Sandy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Sun Prairie wonders about their email account. It's through Charter, and he's wondering if they change providers, would they lose their emails and everything else set up through them?
That's a great question. I think when I had them, or when I had an email account, I regularly checked through them. I think it kind of stuck around. Every company, their email policies and how those accounts stick around tend to change, where sometimes they kind of stick around forever, or if you sever that connection, they may disappear within a month or within 6 months. One item I do know is a variety of services will offer a couple different options. One, they're going to terminate your account within a certain period of time. Two, they're going to terminate it only if you're not using it. Or they'll give you some options where you can forward that email to another email address, meaning that you can continue to at least receive the emails, even if you can't interact with that email on a day-to-day basis, meaning that you can kind of move people towards a different service. And kind of based on that, I tend to use services that would be independent of any other subscription. So, Gmail is generally free, and it's kind of always around, so it's not dependent if you change internet providers. I would recommend contacting Charter if you do have questions. The one challenge is the policies that they have in place today may not be the policies they have in place tomorrow. So even if right now you could keep that account based on their policy, that could change. So I would always plan for it to potentially go away if your service goes away. I know in the past mine did stick around, for better or for worse. I actually wish it would have disappeared, but it did stick around for quite a while. But it always depends on the company. So if you do have concerns with it, contact them. But I would actually plan for that email account to go away, since that does tend to be pretty standard. Because if you're not a customer, they may not want to worry about the upkeep of those accounts, because it's very challenging to do that. So you can always contact Charter or Spectrum, but I would plan for it to go away at some point.
All right, there you go. Mike in Green Bay will give you a chance now. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. You're talking about the phishing or spoof emails. I never click on a link in those, but the other thing I do is, say it's from Netflix, I will forward that entire message to spoof, S-P-O-O-F, at Netflix.com. My understanding is that sometimes they can pull a little bit more information out of the sender and be able to drill down a little bit closer to who the offending party is. And then one other new thing I just noticed yesterday, I'm starting to get Tumblr messages that say, you need to update your Chase account. And I'm just deleting them. I don't follow any of those links. If it says tiny URL, I'm not interested at all. So just a couple of thoughts for people to be aware of. But the Tumblr one is something new that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah. Mike, thanks. Comment, Jesse?
Yeah, the sending the information to Netflix. So if you get, you know, a phishing or a spoof email that looks like it's Netflix, being able to report it to Netflix is good because then they also know what's going on. And it's actually nice to see when you go to a website, hey, by the way, these are the scams we're seeing. We want you to make sure you're aware of it. So being able to report that is actually really, really useful for those service providers. In addition to that, I would always recommend still hitting the spam submission in your email service itself. Because it also lets the email service know that, hey, by the way, this is phishing, and they can help to proactively remove those emails. So you're kind of informing, you know, different organizations because they may not communicate together in terms of these emails. But it helps to protect people receiving those emails by hopefully not seeing them. But also, if people do see them, you know, Netflix or other companies can say, hey, this is what we're seeing. I do see that with like banking websites. You go there and they tell you, hey, don't do this. We see this out in the wild. Be concerned if you get this kind of email. We're not going to ask you for your information over email or over the phone. So it's really good to be able to do that because it does help Netflix and other companies really protect your data. So it's great.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Got an email from a listener who's having trouble accessing live streamed broadcast using the Safari browser. They get a message that says, embed not activated. What might be the problem?
And it could be an extension issue or potentially even an approval through Safari that might be a problem. It could actually be a problem with the website itself, too. There could be a variety of items. One thing I do to at least test it, especially any browser, since there are a variety of options out there, I would recommend installing just any other browser. Firefox, Chrome are two very common ones that work for Mac OS. And try to view the same website in those browsers as well. See if it does function. If it does, it can at least give you a better idea of whether it's an issue with Safari, whether it's an issue with your computer, or whether it's an issue with the website itself. Another item that I would recommend, if you do have browser issues, since Safari is built into Mac OS, I'd also make sure to just ensure that Mac OS is fully updated. So go to the Apple menu, look for updates, and see if there are any updates that need to be applied to your Mac, since it will also include Safari generally. Get all those updates installed and then give it another try. If you do continue to have issues, you can also reset your Safari preferences to default, which will, if there is a bad setting in there, if maybe you click deny on something that is causing an issue for the web page to load, it might help to resolve the issue. I always recommend for everyone, always have a different browser installed because it can help with troubleshooting different website issues. Because with the challenge with websites is there are a lot of browsers, there are a lot of options, and there's a lot of devices. They want it to work for everyone. The downside with that is they really can't satisfy every single option that's out there. And so there can be challenges, and having an alternative browser is useful, but it can also help to separate the information that you're sharing in those browsers, because many browser tabs or browser windows can share data with each other sometimes, depending on how it's built. So having that separate browser can also assist with a little bit of privacy. But I would try a different browser, make sure you have updates, and if you need to reset your Safari defaults to ensure that there's no setting in there that might be causing an issue.
Yeah, and I've actually had that message come up, and I've clicked it off, clicked it back on again, and started it up again, and it worked on the same browser. So just like just a few seconds, and it actually works. So sometimes there's just a little glitch here or there. And there are lots of glitches we can talk about with our guest today, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Again, the number 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And we're talking security and privacy when we're working remotely. Great to have you listening in. Call in with your own questions at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Louise in Madison has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Do you guys have any suggestions for the best ways to store passwords or some way to record them so that you can have them all in one spot without having to remember every single password you've made?
Yes, well, what do you think? I've got different ways that I do it. Oftentimes what happens is I'm making a new password up because I can't remember the old one, and that's not the best way for sure, but it works.
Yep. Yeah, passwords are a challenge, especially now instead of just having one or two accounts. I think I remember one day when I only had one email address that I had to worry about a password for. And now I have, 20, 30, maybe even more services that I have to worry about passwords. And in theory, each password should be different. So it creates an even bigger challenge. One recommendation I'd have, mainly because passwords, just the way things are right now, they're not going away anytime soon. So having a password manager can help dramatically in that. There are a variety of services out there. Many free, or you can pay for some additional benefits or to get family plans. So a password manager basically allows you to have a vault that will basically store the information for all of the accounts that you have and the usernames and passwords for all of those accounts. In addition, the password manager, you kind of have to get into that one password manager, usually with a password. In addition to what I would always recommend by enabling multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication, which will help to protect that vault. Basically, what you want to do with this password manager is protect the vault as much as you can by having this one good password that you know and also protecting it by multi-factor authentication. Because as soon as you're in that, then it becomes responsible for all the other passwords that you have for all the other services. I use a password manager myself. They do work on mobile devices. They work on web browsers. They work on macOS and Windows. And even if you're on an Android or on an iPhone and are looking to fill out a username and password for an application, it can help to remember those too. So you can be on a variety of different services and still pull up and enter that information. And the nice thing is you don't even really have to remember it. You don't even have to see or type in the password because it can autofill that information for you as soon as you've logged in with your multi-factor authentication or even with just that original password. So a password manager would be the way to go. It does help quite a bit, and all the things that, you know, we kind of talk about with passwords and having strong passwords, it definitely puts you in a better position to have strong passwords, because you don't need to remember it because it's all secured in that password vault and it's secure, and you don't have to remember that 20 or 30 character password. It's remembering it for you. So it's something I'd recommend to everyone because, you know, we do live in a password world. One of the other things that I do like about having a password manager is it can also help to tell you if you do have overlapping passwords. So if you want to make sure that you do have unique passwords for every account, it can help you do that and also help you to make sure that you have strong passwords. Also, you might you know, in different relationships, you may need to share passwords because they may not have the capability for a specific service. Maybe it's a cell phone provider or maybe it's a internet provider. They may not have the capability of having individual accounts for each member of the household. If you do have to share account information or share a password because it's common to the household, you actually have a mechanism to share passwords in a way that keeps those passwords protected because you're not writing it down or it's not unencrypted somewhere else. So it can help to keep track of everything and it can help to share it. It does help with general password hygiene. So it's a great thing to have. And you can look for a lot of other cool options and family plans that are out there for a variety of services. So that would be my recommendation. Look for a good password manager. There are a variety of ones out there. 1Password, LastPass, Dashlane, those are very common services. And many of them do have a free offering. And even the free offering allows you to have multi-factor authentication. It also allows you to have it on mobile devices and web browsers. So it'll help you a lot. It'll be a little bit of work setting it up to get all your stuff in there. The nice thing is once everything's in your password vault, you will start understanding exactly how many accounts that you have that you may have not thought about. So it's nice to keep things secure, but it's also nice to know that if you ever had a password compromised, you'll know what was compromised, and you'll know how to reset them because you'll have it in one place.
Louise, thank you so much for calling. Ted in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Ted. Ted, are you there? Well, maybe we lost Ted. Let's try John in Mount Horeb. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if Jesse could talk about DuckDuckGo and the advantages or disadvantages of the DuckDuckGo internet browser.
All right, Jesse, what do you think of DuckDuckGo?
Yeah, so the and we actually kind of chatted about this a little bit earlier too. So even with bots, the idea of getting a kind of a customized experience with Google or other search providers. They basically kind of, you know, they're designed to give you the best experience by kind of understanding more who you are so that you can get the answers you're looking for a little bit sooner. One of the ideas behind DuckDuckGo is it tries to give the same experience to everyone without really profiling the information that you have and trying to really maintain your own privacy as much as possible and delivering a search experience that's going to be the same for every single user. So it tries to enhance privacy by really collecting less data. One of the benefits is it's consistent in terms of the delivery of service that you can get. One of the downsides is you might actually benefit from some of the personalized experiences, whether we want a lot of these companies to collect our data or not. Many of those pieces of data put our privacy at risk, but they can improve the services that we're actually given because they do. It is more customized. We're getting this experience that is tailored to, you know, kind of what we do, what we think, and what we already look for. So you can get a different experience, but it really is meant to be, you know, privacy-driven. We're going to collect less data. You can simply use a service, and you're going to get the data that you're looking for. And, you know, many times with the ads from any browser, because you look at ads through just about every search engine. DuckDuckGo also has ads served from a variety of companies. So you're going to get a consistent ad experience, but it's also going to be very tailored, specifically to the organizations that they're looking for. So there's some, I guess, kind of a risk there because there's a more tailored marketing approach or ads that might be delivered through DuckDuckGo than might be delivered through Google or a different search engine. So, you know, you do get some privacy, which I think is very valuable, but you do get a less tailored experience. So it's kind of a balance there, and yeah, I think it's something that Google and a variety of companies are struggling with, because the less data they collect, the safer it potentially is for us, but also the less benefit you potentially get because you don't get that tailored experience. So I think those are some of the balances you get with the browser, but the idea is you have a tool, use it. We're not going to collect your data because we want to make sure that you know, you have more privacy.
John, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lucy wondered if you knew anything about the Delta browser she saw in a friend's home. She'd like to know more about it.
I have not used the Delta browser myself. It is available on a variety of devices. It really is meant to be kind of a streamlined browser, but I haven't had a whole lot of experience with the browser myself. I think with any browser, it's always good to do your research. The more popular, generally, the more vetted it is. So definitely keep a look on common browsers, but it's always good to look at options because there can be some great innovation.
Jesse LeGru, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We will take a look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse LeGru. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Jesse LeGru back with us, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Talking about bots a little bit today on the show, what and why they're there, and also certainly taking your questions or comments as we move along the program. So, problems with some technology right now? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Barbara in Grand Marsh, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how you doing there, guys?
Great, thanks for calling.
I'm an 81-year-old woman, so technology is not my realm. You're talking about passwords. It costs $10 to go to Walmart, and there's a little password book. And you put your passwords in the book and the date, and it's right there at your fingertips, and it doesn't cost everything any month, all month. It's right there. So I don't know what everybody is worrying about. That's a little book.
Well, Jesse, what do you say?
That is certainly an option. As long as you have the book with you and can keep it relatively secure, really any option that works for the individual to keep track of their own passwords is, you know, a way that could work. And I think if you're able to, you know, maintain a list in a book and keep track of where that book is and make sure that if you basically know what to do in case somebody gets a hold of that book, then that can be as good an option as a lot of the other services, whether they're paid for or free. Everyone's going to have a different option that's going to work for them. And having a book is an option. It always depends. I think one of the biggest challenges people have with any kind of password manager, whether it's physical or digital, is are they going to have it with them when they need it? And so with a physical book, the only potential challenge might be knowing where it is when you need to get access to it. So if you lose the book, what would you need to do? But I think that's the case with a variety of other managers as well. But whatever works, as long as you can make sure that it's secure, you know where it is when you need it, and you follow a lot of the other best practices that are out there. You know, make sure you have a longer password that's complicated that people can't easily guess, and don't reuse passwords. So each password is different for each service. Utilizing a book, if no one can get to that book, can be as, and maybe in some cases more secure than having an online password manager. So it's definitely an option.
There you go. Thanks, Barbara. Appreciate it. Apple and Google have recently announced new security and privacy features. Google has decided they're going to limit the amount of time that they can store our data. Can you explain that? What does that mean, and why is this important?
Yeah, so one of the, I think, challenges we have with any kind of digital storage is the amount of time it just kind of sits there and starts collecting over time. So one of the options that Google had put out there for a variety of their services, including Google Maps, was to offer an option to limit the amount of data that they stored. In this case, to 18 months. So anything older than 18 months would be basically purged. So it would not be stored in Google anymore. And that just assists with not having this data collect and collect and collect over time that either may not be valuable, but also might have information within that history that could be sensitive, at least within a certain context. One of the things they're also doing now is in the future, they would like to not just make that an option, they would also like to make that the default. So by default, a variety of services that Google offers would actually remove data that's older than 18 months. That doesn't include some of their other services like Google Photos or Gmail, but a variety of the other apps that might collect data to help give a better experience. I think we all struggle with even paper records. You start with having one folder one day, and then a year later, a decade later, 2 decades later, you have a file cabinet full of stuff, and you're not sure why you have it. But it turns out that file cabinet has a lot of valuable data if somebody was able to peer into it. And so the idea behind this is we're going to limit what you can hold in a file cabinet, and we're going to start throwing this stuff away when it gets too old, because either it's not valuable to your experience anymore because everyone's experience changes over time, but also to lessen the risk of if somebody gets this 10-year-old data, there might be a snippet of information that could be sensitive when taken into a certain context. The other benefit is, you know, it can save storage space and be a little bit more efficient for them as well. But the idea is if you don't need it, delete it, get rid of that data to help ensure that, you know, your data is private and they're not collecting decades or your entire life for somebody to potentially steal.
Makes some sense. Adrian in Milwaukee has a question. Adrian, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm totally frustrated. I have shut down my Facebook account for the second time as of last week. The first time I shut it down was because I got an email from them that said I added my phone number. I did not add my phone number, so I shut it down. Then I reactivated it because I bought a condo and the condo has a Facebook page, and I thought, well, that would be convenient. So then last week, I received another email that said that I was asking to change my Facebook password, which I wasn't. So I've shut it down again, and there's no way of asking them questions that I can see.
All right. Well, what do you think? How does Adrian attack this, Jesse?
So there's if you did want to continue using your Facebook account, one recommendation I would have would be to take a look at your security settings, and I would set up, if you haven't already, set up something called multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication. This might have been also what the notification you received in terms of, you know, registering a phone number. But if you do go to see your security and login, they do have two-factor authentication, so it can send you a text code or even use an application like Google Authenticator to basically make sure that you're you. One of the challenges with any online service these days is many times the password is the only thing somebody needs to break into your account. Having that two-factor or multi-factor authentication protects your account even further, because not only do they need your password, they also need your device, or they need your phone number, or they need access to that text message. So it'll help to protect your account in the future. What would possibly happen with the notifications that you receive? There's a couple of possibilities that I would usually go to. One could be the email itself was malicious and actually no one tried to reset your password. Or somebody actually did break into your account and was trying to reset your password so they can kind of take over your account or do things you really don't want to be done with it. So I would take a look and I would reset your password, set up the multi-factor authentication, and you also do in that security and login section, there is a where you're logged in page. And that can give you an idea of who might be logging in to your account. And it can at least give you a little bit more security in terms of understanding whether somebody actually compromised your Facebook account or not. There are ways to clean that up. But likely, if somebody else is logging into your Facebook, you're probably going to see it there, and it's going to look unfamiliar. It does have the city and state and country. It also tells you whether it's a PC or a Mac. So you'll get much, much more information from that security and login page under Facebook, and can at least make you feel a little bit more secure. If you do get those emails in the future where, hey, you're trying to reset your password, or, hey, you know, your password was changed, or a different device was registered, you can at least take a look at that page to help you understand whether it's, you know, an email that is malicious or it's a valid Facebook email. So I would recommend taking a look at the security and login section under your Facebook page. I'd reset your password and set up that two-factor authentication. The two-factor authentication should help you immensely because even if somebody does manage to get your password, they shouldn't be able to get your phone number. If you do have an alert-based additional factor, such as a SMS or text message or an app notification, you'll actually know almost immediately if somebody's trying to break into your account, because you're going to get that text message that's telling you somebody's trying to log into your Facebook. So it actually turns out to become a really nice notification mechanism if somebody's trying to log into your account. And that can also help you understand whether those emails you're receiving are really from Facebook, or they could be a different campaign by somebody trying to get you to click on stuff as well. Can be a really, really challenging thing. I think the setting up the two-factor and looking at the where you're logged in are going to help you quite a bit.
There you go, Adrian. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Luke in Crandon next. Hi, Luke.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing? I'm driving down the Highway 8 here listening to the show, and the first part of the show is about bots and you call these communications companies with this 800 number and you talk to a computer. I don't think there's any service involved with it. It seems to me like a way not to give you service. I got a little thing going right now with Frontier, and I'm here to tell you, it's maddening to call those 800 numbers and try to get something done. Is there any communications company out there that has an actual live person? You can dial a phone and get somebody to talk to you. It's just, in my opinion, it's just almost theft. It's just unbelievable. I'll hang up and listen to you. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Luke. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges with bots. I think everyone's had that frustration where you call, you get this bot notification. That's really helped to streamline your experience and help to get you a resolution quicker. And it can sometimes feel like a barrier because you have to jump through four steps to get to where you really want to be, and you know you need to be there right now instead of wait through those four steps. I think that's one of the challenges everyone's kind of going through in terms of implementing these bots to make them the most effective. It is a challenge. I feel that frustration as well. I've been on those phone calls, and I'm like, I really need somebody to call because I know exactly what they need to do. So I think for a majority of the population, it's useful. I think there are outliers depending on what you're looking at. And unfortunately, many times the outliers are paying more of the price than the general consumers because the process actually might be more helpful. Now, with that as well, many times a lot of these bot services do have mechanisms they're listening for to allow you to go directly to a customer service agent, or if you're not already being put in a queue, to be put in a queue. And I know a lot of times you can just simply say customer service, or you can say a keyword, and it will actually put you in queue and ask, you know, are you sure you want to do this? So that can be a shortcut if you kind of know what you're looking for and really need to talk to a person. But each bot service is a little bit different, so what might work for one service may not work for another. So yeah, it's a frustration. I think it's something that everyone's working to improve. Anytime you can give feedback to those companies, I think the better, because usually they will look at those feedback, they will look at those metrics, because they do want to be as successful as they can. So the feedback will be useful to them. But if you can, you might be able to shortcut that system by using a keyword such as speaking with an agent or customer service, or, you know, many others. So if you do have a challenge, there is a potential option there. Some key codes might work too, but yeah, it's a challenge. I feel the pain. I've been there.
I was thinking back to a couple of months ago when I was put on hold and I really needed to talk to somebody because there was a fair amount of money. It was an airline ticket that I was supposed to get refunded. And I plugged my phone into power so that it would be there and it wouldn't die on me. And I waited. I was doing just working 5 hours and 20 minutes. And I finally got into somebody. 5 hours and 20 minutes on the phone. What a mess. Oh, boy. That's a long time to wait, but I didn't have to worry about it as I was doing all kinds of other things. Well, somebody else wondered about this whole business about bots. Are we going to be seeing more of them in the future, especially now as more people work from home, maybe ones that seem even more human-like?
Yeah, I think the dramatic change over the last 4 months of working remotely or learning remotely, doing a lot more stuff remotely, the usage of bots and using it as a very effective mechanism to resolve issues is definitely more of an interest, whether it's interactions by individuals or more automation to allow people to get to a different location a little bit faster. So I do see that increasing over time. I mean, I'm already seeing it within a higher ed of ways to assist the community with requests, and having that kind of mechanism is going to be really, really useful. It actually can be, I mean, the different ways you use bots, including chat bots. So, for example, you know, we always talk about bots in terms of like being on the phone because you have an issue and you want it solved. You might also have that with a chatbot, which is actually interacting in a chat mechanism. Sometimes those can actually be much more effective because it gives you a little bit better way to interact that you don't have over the phone. So if you know what your issue is and it gives you an option of 5 answers and you simply select one of those 5, you can do that very quickly over a text-based chatbot than you can over the phone, because it's hard to understand and remember what all the options are, and it can be delivered far, far faster. So I do see it happening much more often, and I do see it extending much more beyond just the phone call, but via text or via online web chat too. So I think we will see more of it. The automation can be extremely useful, but it can also be challenging to know, are you talking to a real person or not? Especially depending on the information that you're giving back and forth. So knowing that it's a reputable service and that it's, you know, being supplied by the organization that you're trying to communicate with is also extremely important. But I think we're going to see more of it.
Got an email from a listener who is wondering if it's safe to update to Windows 10 for a Windows tablet. They say they've heard some horror stories.
And with any upgrade, it can go poorly. So One recommendation I'd always have for any kind of upgrade is to make sure you have a backup, a full backup of your entire system, all your files. Your applications you may not be able to back up. You'll need to make sure you have information for subscriptions or software packages to install that software and download it. If I would always recommend if you can run the latest operating system and it performs well based on the hardware that you have for your tablet or your laptop or your desktop, I would always recommend having at least close, if not the latest operating system, just to ensure that you have the very latest updates, one for performance, but also for security. So many times software will hit a point in which it's not supported anymore. So you won't get not just security updates, but you won't get functional updates that actually improve the performance of the product. So having that newest software can help you quite a bit in just your day-to-day interactions. So I would recommend updating if you can. It's always going to be a measure also is if you need to. If you're not getting software updates, I mean, there's little options than upgrading, but always have a backup because any upgrade, even one that you've done 1,000 times, it can just take one time to have something bad happen. So just make sure you have a backup and that you can restore from it. Most of the tablets are actually really good at having a hard reset that will restore the operating system from scratch. You may or may not have your files, which is where the backup's the most important, but usually the tablets, they will have a built-in mechanism to do a restoration if you need to, or they'll have a method online that you can do that restoration. So hopefully everything's in place for that to happen very quickly. But I would say if you can, depending on the age, go ahead and upgrade, just back up all your stuff.
Eileen in Madison, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi, thank you so much for this. I just have a quick comment about, Margaret called earlier about passwords, and I simply can't believe that people just don't write down their password someplace. You don't need a book, whatever the comments were, you wouldn't have the book with you. But for heaven's sake, I just can't imagine people just don't write down their password, no matter how many accounts they have. Also, on NPR in April, the CTO, the Chief Technical Officer of Microsoft, was interviewed on a program, and he made a comment that I wrote down, and it said, the more technology we have, the more problems we have. And I just think today's program is reflective of that, the variety of instances and the problems that people are having, and there will never be a hard record of some of the emails and comments and files that people have. Which is fine to eliminate paperwork and things, but there are certain things that just have to be written down, and passwords is one of them. So thank you for taking my call. I know the show is almost over, and thank you so much for your program.
Thank you very much, Eileen, for calling. And in 20 seconds or so, a comment there, Jesse?
Yeah, I think it's important that every new solution we create creates new problems. That's true with technology and everything else. So it's extremely important. And, you know, writing down information is always valuable. Always plan to lose it and protect it where you can. If you have passwords, you want to make sure it's in a place where no one else can see it easily just to keep your information secure. So paper can be very secure. You need to keep track of it somehow. So find a way that works for you.
Jesse, thanks a lot. Look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He'll be back, and we'll do this again with him. Tomorrow, we'll focus on diabetes on the show, talk about the cost of keeping up with you or your loved one's diabetes. We'll also talk about cooking for a person dealing with the disease. So I hope you'll join in for that. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.